morning, everybody. I want to introduce our guest speaker, my friend Ayo Yetendi. Ayo spoke here about a year ago, and we're really happy that she's back here speaking again. Ayo has a background in the insight meditation tradition, and she's also a professor at the United Theological Seminary. She's also teaches in the chaplaincy program at Ukiah in New Mexico. Today she's going to talk to us about Buddhists who were Christians and research on that. I don't know anything about it, but I'm fascinated. And welcome, Maya.
Thank you. Just loudly. Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Yes.
Can you all hear me okay? With the air condition, maybe not so much.
Okay. Turn it down or turn it off.
So I will talk until we get to the boiling point. Right. And then we'll put the air condition back on, and that'll be the end of the conversation. Yeah. I'm glad to be back. Glad to be with you all. Just want to take you in for a moment. Take you in again. All right. Let's see. It is real important that that most of our time together is spent in conversation, largely because I like getting to know you, and also because everyone is going to have their own experience of how you grew up and how you encountered Buddhism, Zen, the Dharma, right? Everyone's story is different. But there may be some commonalities, so we'll see. Let's see. I will begin by asking how many people here grew up in a Christian church? Okay, thank you. How many people grew up in a Buddhist context? How many people grew up in a belief system that was not Buddhist or Christian? Okay. What were those?
My mother read from the Bible. We didn't go to any church.
Okay. I would call that a Christian context. Okay. All right. Okay. Others, thank you. Others.
Just my mom's Jewish.
Okay. Okay.
I was raised secular humanist.
Okay. All right. Tim.
I was raised Unitarian, which is really secular humanist. Mine was.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. So what I share with you today may resonate, may not resonate. It's okay. We can still have conversation about how you understand the confluences of belief systems, worldviews, and your brand of Buddhism or Zen. How's that? Yeah. Okay. So I'll start with a little bit about myself, and I want to pay attention to time. If somebody could give me it's been 20 minutes kind of warning, I'd appreciate that. Okay, thank you. I grew up in the United Methodist Church, went to church every Sunday in my mother's household. That was not an optional thing, right? You had to do two things: go to church and then choose something in the church to do. And choosing a service, service project, what have you, within the church is your way of, or was our way of appeasing God and avoiding going to hell. So it was real important that we do that. I had, like some people, a falling out with the church. My most intense falling out was when I was 16 years old, and we were at church one Sunday morning. Nothing out of the ordinary about this Sunday, except while at church, there was a woman screaming at the top of her lungs outside of the church. It was obviously someone in distress, and it was during the church service. So I remember standing up, and my aunt, who was sitting next to me, pulled on my skirt, because you know, I wore skirts then, didn't wear pants at church. And she whispered, "You better sit down. You better sit down because you don't know what's going to happen to you." And I said, "Someone is obviously in need." So I go outside, small church building. I go outside, I walk around the building, and I see no one. So then I go back into the church, and I remember walking into the church and everybody looking back, right, waiting for me to come back in. And they were still in their places. The pastor was still at the pulpit. The choir had stopped. Mm-hmm. And it was completely silent. And all eyes were on me. And I was disgusted. I could not believe that all the teachings that I had received up to that time would end up in us being paralyzed around someone's need. And then to add to it, to allow a 16-year-old girl to go out there and not have anyone come out looking for me, I interpreted that as I can't trust this community. Even my own mother and my aunt didn't come for me. And so I thought, well, what's the point of this? Right. So that was my major falling out. And maybe you've had, some of you have had a major falling out too. One of the reasons why I'm sharing this, fine. One of the reasons why I'm sharing this information is because if you haven't done a spiritual autobiography lately, I think it's always worthwhile to look back on how did I get to where I am right now? What was that point in your growing up where you said, you know, this doesn't make sense to me, this is not working for me, or, you know, those teenage years for a lot of people where you see the hypocrisy, right? That's what we're good at when we're teenagers. Or we see the hypocrisy of things. And where it set you up for receiving something different. Let's see. So I'm going to skip from age 16 to age 40 in the interest of time. So, okay, forgive me, I'll go back to 39. Okay, it's going to make a big difference. At 39, I was not looking for any particular tradition. Right, I was kind of done. You know. And then the attack on the World Trade Center took place. That was September 11th, 2001. I turned 40 in October. And so, and I was at the airport in Tucson while this was taking place. And I could just feel an anxiety that I had never felt in my life. The long lines, the fear. I don't know if any of you were in an airport when that was happening, but it was mayhem. And I heard two people in line, in a very long line, we thought we were going somewhere, we were not, said, one person turned around and said to the other, "What has the United States ever done to other people in the world to deserve something like this?" And I knew that she was speaking a question that probably a lot of people had. How could this happen to innocent us, right? So I knew we were being set up for a lot of things, but I really couldn't put my mind around all of it. So for my 40th birthday party, I asked people, and I had all these grand plans because I never thought I was going to live to be 40. That's another story. So I had all these grand plans about what we were going to do for my birthday. We were going to party down. We were going to jam. We were going to do all kinds of things. And I was not in the mood for that anymore. And I told my friends, I said, you know, if you bring me a gift, the one thing that I need the most is peace of mind. Because we had heard, if we were paying attention, that the United States was going to retaliate, right? And retaliate pretty soon. We didn't know where, how, who, we didn't know anything, but we knew we were going to retaliate. So I was anxious in a way that had never been in my life. So The present I received for my birthday was a copy of Thich Nhat Hanh's book called Touching Peace. And it was given to me by someone who didn't practice Buddhism, didn't even know who Thich Nhat Hanh was. She saw the title and said, I think you'll like this. This is what you've asked for, right? So I'm like, right. And so I share that story to say that was one of my first encounters with Buddhism. Wasn't looking for it. Wasn't looking for anything but peace of mind. And right around the same time, my application for the Zen Hospice Project had been accepted. I wasn't looking for Zen. I was looking for a hospice opportunity that had a long training program. And they had the longest training program of all the hospice organizations in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I said, well, that's the one I want to be in. So the confluence of those two things, Thich Nhat Hanh's book and Zen Hospice Project, were my positive encounters with Buddhism. And you may think, when you're looking back on your life and your spiritual journey, what was my first encounter with Buddhism like? How did it feel? What was I thinking about it? Was it strange? Maybe it wasn't positive initially, but we can assume that for most people sitting here that it became positive at a certain point, right? Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be here. So now I'm going to skip from 40 to early 50s. In my doctoral program, I'm a pastoral counselor, and so I got a doctorate degree from a Christian seminary, a doctorate degree in pastoral counseling. And I said, I'm going to do my research on African-American Buddhist lesbians in the Insight tradition. And my it's a big group, people, I'm telling you. But my professor said, how many people, so that's you, and how many others? I said, I don't know. But one thing I do know is there's been no research done on us, so why not? So in that project, I was, we had 31 women who responded to the survey. And then of those 31 women, I interviewed 5. And there's a lot that goes into the research project. But what I'll say is that I determined that there are several. Oh, these women had to have grown up in church. Because what I wanted to know is, what is your psycho-spiritual experience of having embraced Buddhism, at least this form of Buddhism, having grown up in church? Like, what does that do to you? What does that do to a person? Was I asking myself that question? Probably.
Yeah.
Yep. You know too much.
Yeah,
you
sorry.
Know too much
That's
about
my
me.
Story too.
Is that your story? Yeah. So, through my analysis, I determined that there, for at least for these women, there are several spiritual movements as it relates to the psycho-spiritual experiences of having grown up in church and having embraced Buddhism. And I will name them for you, and I'd like for us, if you're interested, to talk about them. One is, I'll start with the most controversial one. And I say controversial for Buddhists, because you might have some feelings about this. The first one is called self-preservation. Okay, so you know how we talk about there being no self, or there's non-self elements, or we don't want to do any selfing because that's, you know, building up the ego, narcissistic, and so on and so forth. But what if you embody the type of person who is under attack frequently, either because of sex, race, sexual orientation, right? Is it an act of spirituality to want to preserve yourself, or at least protect yourself, from the onslaught of violence? So self-preservation is one of those movements. Another one, and by the way, these are not necessarily in any linear fashion. If you studied things about or anything about spiritual formation, oftentimes it's presented in a linear fashion. You start here, you work through these steps, and you end up here. Ta-da! You've arrived, right? So this is not linear. We go in and out of these movements. So self-preservation, rejection. There's something about how we've grown up that we've, the teachings, maybe the practices, where we've rejected it completely or in part. So rejection is a part of the spiritual movements. Another one I call migration. That's when we move from one place to another. Either in our minds or physically, we have decided that we are going to be on a path or a journey or take steps away from something towards something else. In that also is longing. The longing can come at any time and come back over and over again. What is it that I'm really wanting to experience? What have I lost that I want to regain? What am I still struggling with that I'd like to struggle through, let go of? What is it I'm trying to find? That's longing. Exploration. I don't know about for you, but for me, one of the things that's really rich about Buddhist practices is that there seems to be no end to it. There's always something to learn. You pick up a book, you pick up a commentary, you read the suttas or sutras, you engage in a practice. You're engaging in the same practices and new stuff comes up. Right? It's so rich. It never gets old. At least not for me. Not yet. I've talked about positive encounter. Relocation. The difference between relocation and... Thank you. Relocation and migration is that when you make a decision about where you're going to be, you've relocated yourself. Okay. This bless you. This is where I sit. Relocation. Integration is happening the entire time, consciously and sometimes unconsciously, or I should say probably more unconsciously than consciously. And as life, as we live life, we are reevaluating all of it. Right? Does this fit? Does this not fit? That is if we feel free to do so. If we feel bound to something, like if I question that, I'm going to go to hell, you know, or these kinds of things, then you're not likely to reevaluate. Transformation is all part of it. You think about how you were, if you ever were a devout Christian, and how you are now, you know that there's been transformation. Right? There's been some transformation. Deity exchange. By that I mean, if you grew up embracing Jesus, and now you embrace no Jesus, or you have another deity in place of that, that inspires you, that you go to, that's what's called deity exchange. So my 20 minutes has come to an end. Let me see if there's anything else before I want to open it to Q&A. You may have heard some people say that practicing Buddhism makes them a better Christian. Have you ever heard that before?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of you some that. Okay. We could speak to that, whether that's the case for some people in the room. I guess the question I want to pose is, given how you grew up, when you had your positive encounter or encounters with Buddhism, do you think you were set up by Christianity, for those of you who grew up in the church? Do you think there was something about Christianity that set you up to appreciate or understand Zen or Buddhism? And if so, have you been appreciative of that? Something we can talk about. The other question I have is, have you ever experienced trying to repress your Christianity? And if so, what is that like for you now? And then one last question I'm posing, and we don't have to We don't have to talk about any of these things. But is there anything about Buddhism or Zen today that helps you appreciate the teachings of Jesus? And now I'd like to open it up for Q&A. Or comments. Doesn't have to be a question, just comments. What has your experience been like? Yes, and then would you also say your name?
Too? Maggie.
Okay.
So I was a volunteer accompanist at the Basilica of St. Mary for many years for the Children's Choir, and I was a devout anti-Catholic. So it presented problems. So one day one of the kids in the choir came up to me, and as part of her practice, she said, we have to interview people, ask them why they love Jesus. And I was like, oh, shit. All right. So I thought, I said, well, Jesus was a great teacher. And I kept us satisfied with that. And part of the reason I went there was that when the primary conductor was gone and I took over, I got the whole Buddha thing with the kids. And when she was there, she would threaten them with Jesus is watching you, this and that. So it was kind of this push and pull thing going the whole time. So that was an ongoing experience for many years. Because that was my background, mm-hmm. was being Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so to find myself doing this was just an interesting position to be in, to see the positive and the negative effects. And I thought through my life how many people have really inspired and mentored me, and it's been an utter frustration to me that all of them have been Catholic. How can this be? Because the mouth is so messed up. Mm-hmm. But the people who were the most generous, giving, and they were all women also. So that has been a question in my mind, how can that be?
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you first, you just made a confession and you're being and we're all being recorded, Maggie.
Oh.
If this recording is shared, will you get in trouble?
No. Who cares?
Well, I'm asking.
Oh, no.
Okay. You still have your job at the Basilica?
No, I'm done.
Okay. Okay. All right. That's a good question, isn't it? How can this be so messed up? And also, how can I have received such love and inspiration from people from the tradition?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
So,
Peter.
Yeah. So just, you know, a little bit early, you know, I said that I was listening to the stories from the Bible, and you said you considered that a Christian upbringing, and that really made me think, because I didn't feel like I had to give anything up because there was really nothing there. And I think it's because my mother brought out the values, not the dogma of the religion. And I think what attracted me to Buddhism is that there was a lot of common ground around the values that I was taught. Not the teachings of the Bible, but the values behind the stories particularly, mm-hmm. that made it comfortable to come here. And then I was thinking, well, what is it that keeps me here at this age? And I think it's because there is a way that the practice here helps me put those values into action in my everyday life. And I didn't feel that from any... I did the whole experiment where I'll go to these different churches, and it turned me off. Because it was all dogma, not pragmatic. Well, how do you live your life according to this?
Mm-hmm.
So there was something about the cushion is the practice, but the purpose is to bring the cushion into your everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
That was really appealing
mm-hmm.
to me.
Thank you.
I'm Carrie. I was raised Catholic, Roman Catholic, and so I know there was a Jesus center to that as a Roman Catholic, but I don't feel like it was... it was the Holy Trinity, right? Or, you know, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. I could never quite get my mind around how I was separate from that. And it made growing up to me, it was separate that these guys were here, right? And I was here, and I could never attain here because I was always separate. it made me angry for many, many years, feeling that, no, I felt like, and it would be blasphemy to say this, that I was God too, you know, that I was part of all of this, and that Jesus was a good teacher, but he was not the only Son of God, you know. So I would, for, so like that separation, I had to really, like, dislike Jesus and dislike that that framework and kind of disown all of that before I could come back to, after discovering Buddhism in, you know, in many different ways. For me, of course, it, as is for a lot of people, is deep and dark suffering. You know, being a single parent, young, with a child, and wondering how I was going to feed him sometimes was like, you know, I gotta find some kind of support here, you know, not just people around me, but like a spiritual support. So Buddhism would pop up in different variations around that time. And I really, you know, hated on Christianity, you know, people, the institution, everything for a long time. Until I came to a point where I could appreciate that it didn't matter to me, that didn't need to be separate, that I could appreciate Jesus' teachings as a person, as a human being who walked this earth, as a historical figure, and as the son of whatever there is, right, as I feel that we are all that, you know, and this interconnectedness, you know, that Buddhism speaks of, just made sense to me, right? Just kind of moved everything together, and that Christianity didn't have to be separate. So where I came to then, where I couldn't attend Catholic Church for a long time, I couldn't enter a Catholic Church for a long time, my mother, you know, had to go on her own, and I started to slowly go on my own and recognize the benefits of this foundation that I had as a, you know, as a child, and that and how that can't be taken away from me. You know, that is part of me. I wasn't raised as a Buddhist. That is not my experience. My experience is, you know, praying in front of the Virgin Mary. My experience is asking different saints for help. And I now can still do that and be a Buddhist.
Thank you. Natalie?
Yes. Well, I have a typical kind of Catholic story similar to Carrie's, so I'll kind of save you that. Because what I want to mainly say about it was, it was just so full of incongruencies. When I was 11 or 12, it just didn't make sense to me. And yes, I am kind of an analytical type and all of that stuff. But I wanted to say, how do I see Buddhism in Jesus? Being raised Catholic, you know, it was kind of weird to me that really Catholics, we studied the Catechism, which was what, dogma. We didn't really study the Bible that much. But then later I got into studying the Bible a little bit. And really, I think Jesus did exemplify mindfulness. He didn't turn away from people that needed help. He didn't kind of, I don't remember ever, I can't imagine a person of his magnitude or Muhammad or any of these gurus that we have, Mother Teresa, turning away from someone, Lazarus, who needed to be raised. He was there. I wonder if you would speak to Jesus in India. Have you read on that?
No. I have a book. I bought the book because I've heard people talk about this.
Oh, yes.
This phenomenon, possibility. But do you want to say more about it?
Oh, well, I must confess, it's high on my reading list. Okay. It has been. I'm in a book club and I'm, you know, trying to finish the book before Thursday. Yeah. But yes, I very much would like to study that. Mm. And I very much see in the teachings of Jesus, which is, I will just give you a preview from talking with people that have read this, that Jesus was he disappeared for a number of years, and he was, you know, in India, and he was studying Buddhism, and I don't know if he studied Hinduism. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be very interesting to me. You know, what did he do there? That's mm-hmm. what I'm interested in finding out. Mm-hmm. And so, that's what I have put together. It's how we believe mm-hmm. that Jesus went to India and studied. Mm-hmm. And I went to India recently and was unfortunately just a short time, but so grateful to go when I will go back. Mm-hmm. And it's just an interesting a couple people said to me, well, India's like an assault on your senses. So that was kind of like, you know, people have a lot of ways of talking about it. But I felt it was not just an external job. It was very much an internal job. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine that as it impacted me, it would not have impacted you so greatly. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I mean, it is, if you study teachings of Jesus straight from the Bible, many Bibles, because there are many, mm-hmm. It does raise a question of how did someone from his tradition arrive at these understandings of how to live life that were so contrary
right.
to how he was brought up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where in the heck did this come from? That's right. I think mm-hmm. which is leading to, well, where was he? What did he come back with? What was he doing? And the way of non-discrimination, which is what you're talking about, Natalie. That's what I'm picking up on. Jesus's way of non-discrimination
yes.
is what we talk about in Zen, right? At least that's how I see it.
Yeah, and I don't think Mother Teresa. Her missionaries, I had a chance to talk to somebody that had known mm-hmm. somebody and ask if you're Hindu or you're Christian or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it. I don't think it's harder than that. So that's how I put it together.
But if it weren't harder than that,
yeah.
why, back to Maggie's question, why are these structures, these bigger communities with the dogma and the doctrine and all that, confusion, why is there that and also these individuals who are so loving and kind coming out of those traditions? Mm-hmm. If it were that easy. Oh, if only were that easy. That's our hand, yeah. Say your name again.
Bill.
Yeah, I know we've met, but I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
That's
hey,
right.
Bill, good to see you.
It's evolutionary for me, obviously. I just turned 77. And that arc has been one of first kind of confusion, but always something was pulling me towards some kind of life, so I guess I would now call spiritual. And I first got really excited about Zen in the late 50s. and so I read Kerouac and all that kind of stuff. And I became a Zen Buddhist. I'm going to be a Zen Buddhist. I'm going to do all this stuff. And I didn't have any idea at all. It was all ego. And I think I thought it would be cool. You know, I'd be like Kerouac. And I also met someone. You being in the chaplaincy program, Rupai, and you think about this. We moved to Florida when I was a kid. And I started elementary school there. And the first day of school, there was a little girl sitting across the hallway, the aisle from me, and we became friendly right away, and we're still friends to this day, and it was Joan Halifax.
Wow.
Yeah, so say hi.
Okay.
And we're still buddies, and she's been a big help on this kind of path.
Uh-huh.
So then I fell into evil ways for a while, and then that changed in 1942, and, I mean, pardon me, I was born in 1942, and that changed in 1984, and so I was looking for some new path, you know, because I'd gone back to being a Christian, and so back to Zen again, you know, and that really kind of worked, and still does, but there was a dis-ease in me. I felt like something was missing. I didn't know exactly what it was. I still am not sure what it was. But I saw a book, which I never read, by Jack Kornfield, I think it was, called A Path with Heart. And that title really struck me. And I realized it was time to let go of all my intellectual stuff about this. I mean, it's still useful. And to say, what is my heart telling me? And by heart, I'm not talking about, you know, the springboard, you know, self-constructed, which I can jump right into the middle of my own narcissistic agenda. You know, it's a lot more profound than that. And that's worked out really well. I've been coming here for a couple of years. I've studied with some other terrific teachers. And I, Thich Nhat Hanh was my face-to-face teacher for about 3 months. But recently, I became an oblate in the Benedictine order, which was fairly recent. I haven't been around here since that happened, so I'm an oblate now. And those really come together for me, because I don't have any, I'm not stuck on right or wrong, you know, and so that it works in a really nice way. And there's one there's one other point. Well, I guess that point is I'm 77, or I tend to forget what the final point is. And even that is a veritable blessing, by the way. The intellectual stuff just doesn't work for me anymore. I know I sit twice a day, and they're like an amalgam, I guess, of Jericho's single point of meditation and contemplative prayer. And it's, for me, most profound. You know, it's just the same one word from time to time. And that seems to be working. And as long as I don't make up my mind about what it should be, that is, when I do that, I'm telling myself what it should be according to my parents, according to everyone else. You know, this false me is telling me what it should be. If I just sit there, and then can carry that out into the world, then that's pretty cool. And it doesn't mean I don't suffer. Of course, but that suffering is, that's my prayers for others.
Thank you. I have a follow-up, two follow-up questions for you. What's your last name?
Alexander.
So when I talk to Roshi again, I'll say, I met your childhood friend. So that's one question. Second question is, what does it mean for you as a Zen practitioner to commit yourself to the support of a Catholic monastic community?
I don't do it as a Zen practitioner, and I don't do it as, you know, part of, I'm part of that Catholic community. It's very vague, by the way. But I don't have any specific ideas about it. I know there's something that works for me. By the way, there's a wonderful book called Benedict's Dharma, which was published by St. John's up there. Patrick Henry was the editor. He's kind of a big deal.
Okay.
And it's Norman Fisher and any number of other Buddhists talking about their experience of the rule of Benedict.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all very positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I have another.
Answer your question.
No.
Right.
No, you didn't. Did you intentionally not answer it? Because if it was intentional, I won't come back to you. But if it was unintentional, I do want to follow up with you.
It was unintentional.
Okay. All right. So I heard you say, I don't do this as a Zen practitioner. And so my question is, how do you not do it as a Zen practitioner?
Did I say that?
Yes.
Okay, I don't do that with some idea of what a Zen practitioner is. I do it as me, a long-time Zen practitioner. I did Shikai in 1996.
Okay.
So I am large. I contain multiple.
Hear you. Okay, all right. Thank you. You're welcome. What's your name?
Val.
Val.
Yes. Thank you. I wanted to address Natalie's question in just a moment, but just a brief. I was baptized Roman Catholic. I'm Irish. Inevitable. But my mother lost the faith when I was about 4, and the whole Mahoney clan walked out. And I was raised... Anybody ever heard of Mandy Hall? In that, it's an arcane, esoteric, difficult to describe. But
Freemason.
Yes, thank you.
Freemason, did you say?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
And Rosicrucian.
Okay.
Anyway, a terrible, raging teenager. But when I finally started to calm down. Somebody handed me a book called The Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. And some of us in this room, I know, have also read that book. But it was transformative. I never got indoctrinated because my mother left the church when I was 4. So I didn't have that sense of guilt and fear that if you don't do this, this father who loves you is going to pitch you into a pit of fire. I taught world cultural religions for 22 years in Lexington, Kentucky, you know, to college students. Mostly, well, I taught Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam to mostly Southern Baptists and Pentecostals. And it was a challenge to find a way. Thank God my mother was Irish, because we can do that. have a little word magic to keep our noses from being flattened, you know? And I kept them off guard, but I got through these points without challenging their own spirituality. Mm-hmm. And it was helpful. But what I was trying to tell you, Natalie, that question is wonderful, because I know some people have that. I certainly do. But in my intellectual self-training, just following paths that are of interest until you get a good answer, there was an Indian king named Ashok, and he was brutal. He brutalized, massacred huge numbers of people. But Buddhism had been around in India for about 200 to 50 years. And his wife was a Buddhist, and she helped him better understand the meaning of life. He converted, and he sent out missionaries. There's nothing worse than a convert, they say, you know. But he sent them out throughout Asia. But some of those missionaries got as far west as the Middle East, what is now Israel, Palestine. And there's a community of mystics, Jewish mystics, called the Essenes. Many of you folks know of them. There's no doubt in most people's mind, you know, who know about this, that they connected. And Jesus may have spent some time there and learned about the teachings of them. But I'd like to talk with you more about that sometime. I wanted to ask you, what happened? Why? It's a loaded question, and I apologize, but you know, I used to try to get across to my students. Originally, apparently, there were 104 Gospels. That's my understanding. Thomas and all sorts. But it's been reduced to 4, and these students that I taught who were so scared of thinking outside of that narrow little box that they were going to be punished eternally. I tried to open the door, at least show them a door, that maybe, and some of them did hear it. I wasn't trying to convert people. I was trying to help those who may have these very same questions, that there are doors of perception, and if you want, you can go in there.
You kept your job? You're very skilled.
I got as high student evaluations as any professor on campus.
You are very skilled. Yeah. But you said your mother, your Irish mother. I didn't know what all that was, but okay, it worked. Can I ask you a follow-up question? So how old were you when you encountered the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna?
22. I've just been in the Air Force for 4 years. 65 to 69. You could either join the Air Force and learn Russian language and go to Bavaria in northern Japan, or go to Vietnam and kill people and be killed myself. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm crazy, but I'm not stupid. I'll take the Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And it opened doors of perception I didn't even know existed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from LA, you know, I'm the center of the universe. It isn't. I learned.
Was your encounter with Sri Ramakrishna, the Gospels, was it positive?
Very much so, because it spoke to things that I felt deep inside me, deep spirituality. I didn't know other people thought.
Mm-hmm.
And here was a whole world religion, a massive one,
mm-hmm.
that addresses those issues.
Right.
So I founded an ashram in the mountains of, I'm from LA, it's in La Crescenta, it's called the Ananda Ashram. It was founded by a disciple, a two-generation removed disciple of Ramakrishna.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there for years. I still go there and visit.
Mm-hmm. Would you, just looking at the time, would you agree with the statement that in your positive encounter with the Gospels of Sri Ramakrishna, you received Christianity as well as Dharma simultaneously?
I never was instilled with the divinity, the special divinity of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Master teacher, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And enlightened, without question, highly evolved, as a bodhisattva, as others, but not as God incarnate, mm-hmm. or the only Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt that.
Mm-hmm. But the teachings...
mystical teachings.
Yes, the mystical teachings.
But not the dogma.
Mm-hmm. No. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Eileen. So I guess I was raised Catholic as well, an Irish Catholic. So the Irish part is really strong. I was, feeling very devout as a little kid. I loved to go to church. I just loved it. And it was all, our little parish was mostly in Latin still. So I liked the sing-songy kind of chanting that we all did. I raised an absolute fit when, Bible study came for little kids, so that the parents could be free of their children and send them away. And then the more adult children or grown-up children would go. And I raised such a fit in that room that the teacher could not handle me. And she said, Mrs. Tech, you're going to have to take your job back. And because I wanted to be in that place where it felt so mystical to me. And I loved the aura of being in that place. And the priest never looked at you. I remember asking my mother, why doesn't Father Eve look at us? And she said, because he's talking to God. And so then it was, again, a more mystery. Lots of incense, high candles. And then when I was about 8, the reforms came. They turned the priest around. He's facing us. And now there's guitars and charismatic groups. And everything became... And they changed everything to English. And I was diligently studying Latin. I would take my little missal, the little prayer book, and I'd sit in the hallway, and I would just keep reading it, so that I'd get it right. And my mother would look at me, she goes, what are you doing? And I said, I just want to get this part right, so I would practice. Well, then all of that was gone. Everything was gone. And I was devastated, and my mother, she's like, oh, thank goodness, we finally, you know, come around to the 20th century. You know, she was just so happy to finally have everything in English, and, you know, and I, so then I asked her during Mass once, you know, like in these early days, I said, so who's the priest talking to now? And she said, what? And I said, who's he talking to now? You know, we're in church. And I said, well, if he's not facing that way, talking to God, then who is he talking to? Us? And she was, and she looked at me. She just was so puzzled. She was, oh, just never mind. Follow the line. And she just wanted to stop it, and we never talked about it. You know, and it kind of went from, you know, one bad thing after, like, you know, we were a little missionary. You know, our little parish was considered a missionary. So we had all these wonderful priests from all over. You know, they came from Brazil, they came from Denmark, they came from, I mean, it was really kind of neat. And, but then now all of a sudden, no, the priests weren't migrating a lot. They're mostly just American priests. You know, and then the next thing, you know, we got a new pastor, and, you know, and all he talked about was, you know, for a homily was how much money everybody, you know, the church needs, and how, you know, you're not giving enough money, you know. And they eventually got rid of him because it was so bad. But all these things started to make some really, you know, impressions on me. Mm-hmm. When I was 15, I told my mother, I'm not going to church anymore, just forget it. And it wasn't until I was, and she said, fine, you don't have to, because I made such a stink about it. So by the time I, you know, was in my 20s, I, you know, I had a lot of really, just got pretty interesting life. I had a, you know, it got pretty rough. And so out of that, that suffering of a boyfriend suiciding, you know, I don't like to say commit suicide, mm-hmm. sounds like a crime. Mm-hmm. He was very ill, mentally ill, but yeah, he died by suicide, and it sent me into this whole tailspin of, you know, what's happening here, you know, what do I do? I feel so lost. I was living at, you know, down in Tucson, Arizona, and I'm, you know, I'm 20, you know, and I'm just looking. So I see the Hare Krishnas, you know, in the street, you know, they're, you know, in some street festival. And I'm looking at it, and I look at this guy, and I'm like, my God, you know, look at you, like, you know, you glow, you know, you absolutely glow. And I was so interested in finding out, how do these people sit and, you know, do kirtan in the mm-hmm. street, and how, you know, they just glow. And they that's how I wanted to feel. And, you know, but then a friend at work had a wife, his wife was involved in this very new age kind of group, and he said, why don't you come on over to the house and have lunch and, you know, talk to her, she wants to talk to you, you know, because I was just, you know, he was a good person to talk to, you know. He said, yeah, you're going through a lot right now, so I want to be very healthy. And so I went there, and then of course she had all the books and, you know, everything. It was good, it was kind, it was warm, it was loving. But that's where, you know, everyone was talking about reincarnation and, you know, karma and, you know, I got all of that. So that was from this very eclectic group. And they were international. And lots of good and bad with that. And I actually joined that church. So that was, and I moved back here to Minneapolis. And they had a group here, and so they talked about Buddhism, they talked about Hinduism, they talked about, they took every Judaism, everything, they took everything and put it into a you know, one-stop shop. And so I liked that because it gave me a chance to practice, and there was Christianity in it too, mm-hmm. you know. Was there, everybody was there, even though I was pretty pissed at Jesus. And I was mad at God because I grew up in a really addictive home and lots of drugs and alcohol. And no matter how hard I prayed, mm-hmm. nothing ever changed. Everything just got worse. Mm-hmm. So that was also another separating point for me. You know, like, okay, salvation, child suffering, no, this isn't working for me. So, but when I did find this other group as a young person, I think that that gave me a sampling of a lot and gave me a place to to kind of land. But, you know, then there's also this kind of specialness in that group. Like, we're special. We're a little bit above the rest of everybody else. Follow this and you'll be, you know. So again, it was kind of the fear-based stuff. And you know, we're us and then there's the them. And I didn't like that separation of, like, it's all us here trying to live in this little bubble. And then, you know, everyone else is out there. So, I mean, for 14 years I did that. And I just, it just was not good. It actually was almost like a reflection of my dysfunctional family.
And really?
we discovered these links. And so I did separate from them, and, you know, and then I went right into the Hare Krishna for, you know, a few years. And then that was good until that became that same kind of thing. And so I just kind of moved on to, I mean, I even went to Wiccans. I went to, you know, goddess culture. I went to just everything until I finally landed into Zen Buddhism before I came here, but I couldn't do it. Because all the meditation I did was all kind of out of body stuff. And then I thought, and then the priest there would say, you know, you have to stay here. You have to stay here. And I said, well, I don't want to stay here. It hurts. And then they said, but that's what this is. So it just took a while before I was able to, you know, finally, you know, just get a lot of other types of help for myself, which were so necessary, you know, before I think I was able to really come here and to really, you know, take up a practice like this. And I just want to just make one little just addition.
I think we have, what, 1 minute?
I just want to say that in that other group, though, we did study about Jesus going to Tibet. Madhavan Sari, and I believe it was Nicholas Rorick even, I mean, it's just different, he was an artist, have gone there, and they asked to see the scrolls, and this were, you know, if the Tibetans had actually written down where they had seen him, and some Tibetans had actually gone through Jerusalem, and this is just the story of what I heard. And there's a book of that. But they had, after the murder of Jesus, they actually saw him, because they recognized him from when he was in Tibet. And they traveled back, and then they wrote in, you know, that they know now that he was dead. So, and then his mother actually went with the caravans and brought groups of people to Tibet because she was an Essene. So anyway, that's what I am about that.
Okay. Thank you, Eileen. I know our time is, we got 30 seconds, so I just want to say thank you. I can imagine that sitting was difficult because you had a lot to sit with. You've traveled a lot. A lot of different belief systems. Anyway, time is really of the essence now. I just want to say Hare Krishna. Krishna, 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 Hare, Hare. And say to you all, thank you so much for your involvement, your participation, sharing your stories, your questions, the unanswerable questions that we live with and continue to live with. Thank you for letting me practice with you today. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.